A podcastlet of the cinema. Yes, a little midweek extra. No, this is the Jumbo Fun Pack. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. That's Dave White, and we are popping in a little between episode because we're super excited about a new book that's out. Our dear friend Stephen Rebello, you know him as the author of Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. He is one of the architects of the original bad movies we love for Movie Line magazine. He writes about film and so much other stuff for Playboy right now. Has a book out that is really one of the most essential volumes that you can have in your house, and could not be better timed as a delicious, chewy, addictive piece of escapism, because heaven knows we need that right now. The book is Dolls, 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 Deep Inside Valley of the Dolls, the most beloved bad book and movie of all time. It has already gone into its second printing because the world needed to know. And we're so thrilled to have with us today via the miracle of Zoom. Stephen Rebello is here. Welcome, sir.
I am so excited to be here finally. Although I'm a little wary of going under the knife. I always have been, but let's see. Let's see.
Oh, please. No, this is an hour of fan service, not to worry. You know, you share our, you transcend our obsession with Valley of the Dolls, but we get it. We get where this is coming from. But tell us about the steps by which you realized there was a book in this.
Well, Ed Margulies and I had just finished Bad Movies We Love, the book, and we did a little psychotic tour on TNT for a bit, and I insisted on getting out of that, but we won't go there. But we wanted to work together on something else that wasn't on television, and an editor had been suggesting that I do a book about a bad movie we loved, that I truly loved, and that I thought there might be a story behind. And so we met with a publisher, and that all worked until it didn't. And I just, I let it go for many years. As you know, of course, Ed passed away, and for a while I didn't want to write it without him. And then I did. Because I thought that wherever he is in the cosmos, he might get a rip roaring laugh out of it, and just the fact that I was doing it on my own, and so I had a take on it that was very different from what we were going to do that first time around. Because a lot of time has passed, I've evolved, I look at the movie, I look at the world, I look at myself very differently than I did then. And I thought, would somebody be crazy enough to sign up to this thing? So we went out to publishers, and the editor who edited this book that you now hold sort of in your hands, or I will in a second, is the editor who wanted to do it all those years ago. And so... I don't know. Did I just answer that question?
I'm not sure. No, totally. Okay. I have to say, I know you may not have loved doing that TNT show, but it was huge for me. Like, that was the first time I got to see the Oscar. It was the first time I saw Susan Slade, a lot of the stuff that's in the Bad Movies We Love book that were not as readily available at the time. On whatever home video we were looking at that moment. So that show actually did sort of unearth a lot of gems from the from deep in the vault.
Well, thank you. That's really lovely of you to say that. I've heard that from a number of people, and I always appreciate it. What was fun for me was writing the intros and the outros, and coming up with a concept that would, basically my conversations with TNT were always about, look, we're in a Ross Hunter set. We're in a penthouse somewhere, high above Manhattan. And we have really weird neighbors. And those neighbors were going to be Sharon Stone and, you know, people we wanted to bring in, Ileana Douglas and all of that. So it didn't quite become that, but I really enjoyed that. What I did not like, which you didn't ask, but I wanted out in the world, was that the director who was like the female equivalent, or actually the producer was like a female equivalent of Mark Robeson. What kept pushing us to be really gay, like be really like, you know, and I went, you mean like Liberace gay? That's really what you're talking about here. And I, you know, you can see I was trying it. It was not, that part was not happy. What I loved was meeting people who saw the show and loved seeing those movies. And I loved revisiting them. So all that was good. But when they wanted me to like sign on for another stint for like a lot of time, I went, honey, you know, the 7-year contract went out with Warner Brothers and I'm not doing that. And you know,
so you guys rolled Pepsi bottles under your feet like Joan Crawford. How much gayer do they want it?
Yeah, we did. And you know, I was very happy with ideas like, you know, filming an entire episode in LanaVision, which I thought was, you know, you know, kind of fun. And the people who got it. I got such beautiful fan mail from smart people, you know what I mean? Like smart people who knew me and went, what are you doing? This is not like you, but it's kind of delightful. So thank you for that. I answer nothing with like four.
No, these are the gems. That's what we're here for. So you mentioned Mark Robeson, who is of course the director of Valley of the Dolls, and had a fairly contentious relationship with his stars. Coming off of Alfred Hitchcock in The Making of Psycho, where you're working with somebody who was an auteur who had this, you know, amazing sense of control and, you know, completely envisioned the film before he shoots a single frame. What was it like to go from that to this movie that just seemed to be ruled by chaos from the get-go?
Yes, that's a great question. It was really surprising because I was, you know, once I got into the archives of, you know, various producers and directors and even actors, what startled me was the Valley of the Dolls that people had in their heads, the one they wanted to make, which was, it wasn't Hitchcock, but it was very informed by movies of the era, Darling, for example, or Blow Up, or even the Georgie Girl, Victim. I mean, all of those movies and many, many more were referenced. Funny Girl, because of use of color. And I was also startled because I didn't know by the numbers of people who worked on that movie who had really impressive resumes. You know, I mean, from cinematographer who worked with Garbo and, you know, and the biggest stars at MGM, Norma Shearer, right. Jim Crawford, all of them, to, you know, production designer who, you know, worked with the great German directors and continued to. So, you know, so the aspirations were really high. I think going after Harlan Ellison as a first screenwriter is an indicator that they weren't necessarily trying to do the same old, and they were also trying to take the quote unquote curse, if you want to call it a curse, off the Jackie Suzanne's novel being mawkish or overly sentimental. They wanted to take kind of a, what I call the Joan Crawford kind of the tough baby approach, which is, you know, but, you know, very knowledgeable about Broadway and Hollywood and, you know, and very, if not in on the joke, then certainly in on the numbers of cliches and tropes that they were, you know, that they were going to resurrect, but they wanted to do them in a fresh way. So, you know, so no, by no stretch of the imagination was this going to be another Psycho or Vertigo or something like that. But it's surprising the numbers of references to great movie directors and great, you know, production design and great color palette and costume design that they were kind of shooting for.
You know, one thing that surfaces a lot in reading the book is you sort of realize that somebody who worked in movies in the 80s who still works in movies now the equivalent for 1967 is you had people who worked on silent film who were still like active in the industry. And so like we forget how quickly things pass by and how relatively short the entire history of cinema is in a lot of ways.
That's a great point. I mean, you know, just we talked about Mark Robeson for, we touched on him. I mean, look at the fact that, you know, he was in the editing room at RKO with Robert Wise, and they were, you know, they're working on Orson Welles movies, and they're working on Val Lewton, Jacques Tourneur movies, and, you know, not a bunch of schleppers. And Robeson's early career had been about toughness, had been about, you know, had been about edge, had been about grittiness. And, you know, and then when he, you know, he got taken up in the 40s and into the 50s, his reputation shifted and women's pictures kind of came into it. But, I've written this book and the mystery of Mark Robeson still remains for me. Like, what happened? You know, because anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I could really never figure out why, on this one particularly, he was so tone deaf and so, unable or seemed just completely inexpressive in how to deal with women, particularly, just a clod.
Well, Dave and I were talking before we started about where this kind of falls into the sort of lineage of the woman-centered Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you know, just out loud, why this movie? You know, like, what about this movie, you know, made it such a gigantic success at the time? Even without the book, because I mean, if you'd read the book and then you went to see the movie in 1967, you would see how radically different the movie is from the book. And I was just thinking out loud, like, do we think that women and also gay men who were, you know, going to see this movie enthusiastically and loving it were simply seeing a shred of the reality of what life was like, you know, finally on a screen? You know, there's the idea that a woman, an ambitious female character in a movie, could have that ambition for up to a point, and then she would go get married, which of course is sort of what happens, ish, to the Barbara Parkins character. I mean, she doesn't wind up with, you know, anyone at the end, but she's saves herself. But the idea that, you know, the limitations on what a female character in a film could do up to that point, and the production code falling away, what do we think that sort of was a flashpoint for female audiences and for gay men to just hear the word, that F word, about themselves, like, oh, we exist, you know?
They're talking about us in a movie.
Yeah, they are. They're sort of, you know, it's, I didn't hear you, David. Such a what?
Sorry, I'm talking over you. It wasn't a cool movie. You know, late 60s, you know.
The Easy Rider crowd was not embracing it.
Cinema, it was an old fashioned movie, but there was still this rawness inside. Anyway, I'll shut up.
No, there's a lot there. Well, you know, you'd be the first to say that the book was so enormous that there was, you know, that people were curious to see what, you know, it's like, how in the world did they make a movie of Lolita? I mean, it's, you know, it's the same sort of gambit, which is, oh, will that scene be in it? You know, the same gambit as a Harold Robbins novel to movie. Are they going to film that? So of course there'd be a built-in curiosity, and the book was gigantic. You know, so there was that. You know, and I don't think we can ever discount Betty Rollin and her piece in Look magazine, her cover story, which I know millions of gay men tuned into because, you know, you didn't write about that in a cover story about a movie coming out and that being, they hate each other. Look, they're actually dissing each other, you know, at a time when publicists sat on these kinds of things. They didn't talk about, you know, I mean, for a co-star to like Patty Duke, to call Barbara Parkins Barbara Starkins, that's a big deal. So look, gay audiences were certainly tuned in because of the book, and they knew the movie was going to be something, you know, whether it was a meaningful something or something to goof on. I know I did, but I think the underlying question, or maybe the overlying question about women, is you know, for me a more interesting one, in that you know, Valley of the Dolls follows in the tradition of really, you know, if you want to go back to the 40s, Kitty Foyle about or The Best of Everything or
female.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly, female. What happens to women who refuse to stay in their lane? You know, what does that mean? Even if as a gay man you hear somebody being called a fag in a movie and it's acknowledged, that's still a something. That's better than it never, you don't exist, you never existed, you will never exist. I think even for women, we were willing to take scraps. So women who came to New York or came to Chicago or came to LA, who dared to want something more, you know, who dared to say that, you know, maybe there was a life beyond marriage, and, you know, and all of that. At least there was some kind of representation on the screen, whether it was the kind of representation that, you know, in terms of gender, not in terms of, you know, not in terms of race or ethnicity or anything like that, but in terms of another woman on screen who is daring to say, I want a career, you know, try and stop me. And then what happens to that? I mean, and in Valley of the Dolls novel and movie, you get the spectrum. You get the young, ambitious newcomer who doesn't know yet what lies ahead of her. You get the, on the opposite end of the spectrum, you get the older woman who's seen it all, been through it all, suffered it all, and knows exactly what that young woman is going to face somewhere down the road. You know, I also think that at least I sort of downplayed the fact that during the 1960s, the pill popping stuff was really beginning to be talked about. The drug stuff was really beginning to be talked about, but it wasn't being talked about in terms of women so much. And the fact that Jackie Suzanne dared speak its name, yeah, beautiful, rich, ambitious, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, white women take drugs too, get it? And that was a revolution. But also the fact that she wrote the book and they made this movie, I think we all forget that those people were taking a risk. I mean, aside from the fall on your face, slip on the banana peel kind of risk, but you know, the risk of, oh, she must really be like that, you know, or she must be a drunk, or she must be a pillhead. Because it wasn't being talked about in polite society until Jackie Suzanne and some others, you know, spoke up. So, you know, I mean, I think there were a lot of vectors that were sort of connecting. But I think for a lot of gay people, once they got into the movie theater, they just laughed. They just laughed at how inept it was, how square it was, how 1947 as opposed to 1967 it was. And you know, and there's a lot of comfort in it. It's a warm blanket in a way, because it the Valley of the Dolls movie is, it's so Joan Crawford, it's so Bette Davis, it's so Irene Dunne, it's so old Susan Hayward, it's all those late show cliches wrapped into one. It's every showbiz musical from Broadway Melody to, you know, whatever. It's the three girls go somewhere and happens. And, you know, and in this one, shit happens while they're wearing really lots of high-piled wigs and, you know, and lots of fancy clothes, you know, with lots of really dull men. We've all been there.
Well, you know, in the Bad Movies We Love book, you know, you and Ed Margulies had an entire chapter called A Gaggle of Starlets. And, you know, you put this movie very much on a continuum of films like The Best of Everything, Three Coins in the Fountain, The Pleasure Seekers, Where the Boys Are, even like, you know, this three, four women go to a place or, you know, move to New York or try to, you know, make it in the world. But, you know, those movies, while they all have their entertainment value, like none of them are Valley. No. So what is it about Valley that makes it sort of stand, you know, fall and bouffant ahead atop the other ones?
It's its utter ineptness. I mean, virtually from start to finish, it's nothing lands. The performances don't land. Especially the ones where the real go for the throat performances don't land. And I, you know, I'm of the mind that they could have, if there were actually a script that, you know, sort of motivated what's happening with Neely, you know, and so Patty Duke's, you know, excesses and her likability and her vulnerability would have had a context, and it doesn't in the film because the director, well, they never got a good script, but beyond that, the director, you know, only cared about it's pills, just keep hitting the pills, drop the pills, turn the bottle of pills, move the pills around, without trying to figure out why are these women really up against the wall and what does that feel like. So you know, so there's that, and I just, you know, I just think I think especially now it has kind of that mid-century stuff that we're, you know, that we're all kind of gaga about, those clothes, that hair, those attitudes, you know, the Sharon Tate-ness of it. She's pretty spectacular and touching. And, you know, and Barbara Parkins clearly looking at the camera or, you know, listening in her own head to, I am the next Joan Crawford. I am the next Greta Garbo. I am all those things. And look, I'm being photographed by the guy who photographed Joan Crawford and Greta Garbo. So how the hell can I miss? You get all of that. And it's, you know, it's just delicious. Quotable lines. Although I'm going to come out and say, I'm from a family and a generation, and the generations before me where, you know, lots of aphorisms and lots of sayings were used. I'm from New England. I'm from Lawrenceville, pretty much. But the point of that is that, you know, when Lee Grant says all cats are, you know,
at night all cats are gray.
Oh, at night all cats are gray. My grandfather said that. And he told me that about women, you know. You know, and so it was like, why are these people laughing? Okay, the delivery's funny. And you know, and I get that, but you know, I'm old enough, and I guess lucky enough to come from a world where, you know, people said things like that, like in Psycho when Martin Balsam's character says, "If it, you know, doesn't gel, it is an aspic, and this isn't gelling." It's like my father said that, you know. I mean literally, before Psycho. So. You know, so, but the dialogue is, you know, funny, and it's I think one of the things that for me resonates so much is that it's a movie that thinks it's hip and advertises itself as hip and edgy and ooh, like it's, you know, it's we're so daring right now. and you're watching it going, yeah, well, Irene Dunne could have done this in the 40s. So
when Helen Lawson says ass and they have to cut to Barbara Parkins recoiling, like, oh, she said that.
Yeah. Great. I mean, cause she's recoiling for the character and she's recoiling for the audience too.
Yeah.
So they're very, you know, they were very canny about, you know, appealing to the blue haired lady or the, you know, the Park Avenue matron who also saw the movie and either felt that way about words like ass and tin can and, you know, I mean, whatever, all of that, you know, all those things. Or like many Americans who persist in wanting to believe that that's what we really are, what they really are. So it was, you know, so that was a very, very smart thing to do. I mean, you know, I talked to someone who's actually in the line at at Valley of the Dolls when it was, you know, open, that the night it opened on Broadway, the one that Irving and Jackie were actually observing. That wow. line where they were, you know, they were drag queens in the line. They were bikers. There were, you know, they were working girls. I mean, and when I say working girls, I mean, Rona Jaffe, Best of Everything working girls. There was, you know, there were secretaries and legal assistants and all that. And there were, you know, there were couples and there were hipsters. I mean, you know, beatniky people and lots and lots and lots of gay people. And so, it was zeitgeisty. So, you know, when Jackie said, Irving, these are my people, she wasn't kidding. Her people were the people who went to cry, who went to laugh, who read the book, or people like me who went to cry and were absolutely willing to laugh too. So I did, there.
So, I mean, this is purely a hypothetical, but, you know, I think it was Pauline Kael said about now Voyager that if it were any better, it wouldn't be any good at all.
That's right.
You know, and I'm wondering if they had even a shred of an idea, a better idea of what they were doing and how they were presenting it, would this have just sort of been another, you know, the pleasure seekers or whatever, or did it have the potential to really be, could you turn the sow's ear of this book into a silk purse?
Yes. And it would have been done. You know, Ernie Lehman, the screenwriter of North by Northwest and Sweet Smell of Success on and on, was my mentor. And we talked about Valley of the Dolls because he was offered it. Philip Dunn was offered it. William Wyler was offered it as a director. Joe Mankiewicz, even with Cleopatra, was offered it. I asked Ernie if there were a way, if he saw a way into that book that could have been meaningful, and he told me. He told me his approach. You know, he didn't want to do it, and he didn't need to do it, but I think it's why they went after people like Don Siegel or Joe Mankiewicz, because they thought, you know, with the right auspices, if we get, let's say we get Julie Christie, whom they pursued, you know, as everyone did, and she said no to basically everything. And, you know, if we get Candace Bergen, even if she can't act yet, but she'd be a wonderful Anne. If we get Anne Margaret to play Neely, you know, can this be something else? Can it be all about Eve in, you know, for the
miniskirts?
Yeah. So, but you know, I mean, there was even talk, and Ernie told me about this. There was even talk about, you know, doing it in period, and you know, in three acts, where they're, you know, they're in one period and then it changes. That could have been interesting. I mean, look, Mark Robeson made Peyton Place. That was a female novelist. A book that I'm rereading right now because I can't believe how good it is. And I can't believe how many people think that it's just sex. It's so clear that that's not what Grace Metalius' game was. What she's talking about, social class, and how social class looked differently at things like incest, how social class gets treated, how different people of different social classes get treated differently by doctors. I'm finding it fascinating, but then I'm from New England, so I'm going to. But Ernie and others had talked about getting at the heart of what made you know, Jacqueline Susann's book so popular, but giving it, you know, an underneath, you know, giving it something else. I'm sorry that any of those movies didn't happen. But I'd also, I'm not sure that we would be talking about that movie right now, which, you know, goes to your, you know, earlier point. Could Valley of the Dolls be worse? I suppose, but I guess I don't see how it could be much more fun than it is. So there's that. These days, I'll take fun.
I love that you devote so much time and space in the book to the Harlan Ellison treatment, because, you know, that it, unless you go deep into a studio archive, like I read it at one point, but it's, you know, a lot of people don't know it even happened or certainly haven't read it. And I think that he, you know, hits on a way that could have, that would have felt more 1967, that would have felt more relevant to the time and, you know, sort of spruce things up a bit.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, and I have you to thank and for many things, but that's one of them, you know, make sure to get back to Harlan. And so I was going back to Harlan. I read that thing twice and I could see where he was going. And I clearly you did too. He was influenced by, you know, the Nouvelle Vague, and he was clearly influenced by, you know, movies that were coming out of England. You know, Lion Burke is, you know, bearded and long-haired, and he, you know, he's a kind of a tortured artist. He's Harlan, basically. He's, you know, I mean, he's like an idealized version of Harlan Ellison, and you know, and there's lots of groovies and babies and, you know, far outs in it, and so yeah, I mean, he was indeed trying to make it less square and more relevant. Now, you know, I would have liked to have seen that movie too. Again, had they done it that way, we might be giggling about the anachronisms of, or the sort of the time capsuleness of the 60s-ness of it all. But I, you know, I applauded that treatment. I mean, it's a really detailed treatment, as you know. I mean, it could practically be turned into a screenplay with, you know, a couple of weeks' work. I, you know, and I'm so glad you're focusing on that as opposed to why we think he may have been fired, because almost everyone else that I talk to wants more dirt, and like, where'd that come from? And I go, blame Alonso, he knew that story. I unearthed plenty of dirt myself. I mean, I had to, you know, put my eye in a lot of keyholes, which is probably why I got this infection in my right eye. But you know, you're responsible for that one. I couldn't be more pleased and chuffed.
And y'all can read the book for that story.
It's worth the price of admission.
Totally. So now, did you get a feel for what was going on at Fox between like 1970 and 1995, that this movie had been such a gigantic hit then just was completely buried?
That became the era, it started to become the era of the blockbuster and the space movie and the, you know, and the franchise. And, you know, look, it took the gays to let people know that this movie matters to a lot of people. They let it fall by the wayside, as they did a lot of other movies of the era, but this was very high profile, this movie, and it made just a ton of money for them, you know, on a relatively small investment. So that archive thing and what's important to the studios has always mystified me, but they were looking for class and prestige and money and things that would have a broad audience appeal. All the things that I was told I shouldn't write this book, really, who's interested in a movie from 1967? And who knows about any of these people that are in it anymore? Lots of people, it turns out.
But. No, I was going to ask, because I mean, clearly, you know, you said I tried a book about Psycho, and it's like, oh, well, of course, that's in the canon, and we all, you know, we understand this is a work of important American art. But I wonder what kind of obstacles you might have faced in terms of people going, Valley of the Dolls, who cares?
Well, so it was not only Valley of the Dolls, who cares, but you, Valley of the Dolls.
Do they, have they met you?
Yeah. Well, they have, but you know, I don't reveal to everyone, but get to know me, you know. The thing about that is, there are a couple of things that I loved about what you just said. One is, when I proposed to publishers that I write a book about Psycho, I was turned down by 14.
Wow.
The book was published by the only man who said yes. And, you know, another part of that is that so many people said to me, especially people in Hitchcock's, you know, circle, why this movie? I mean, why don't you write about it? And they would always have another title of things that I could or should write about. A lucky thing for me about that particular book was most of the people who were involved were part of his TV crew. I mean, in terms of
Yeah,
where you really learn things is from the people who are on the crew. For me, that's, you know, they weren't coached by publicists. They don't have, you know, they don't have this, you know, this facade to keep up. You know, and with these people, because they were mostly involved with television, they hadn't been interviewed. Nobody had talked to them. I found them all wherever they were, in trailer parks, in you know, in mansions and everything. And they were among the most fantastic, wonderful people. And I keep in touch with some of them still. Some of them are still alive, thank goodness. So you know, so there was that. So yeah, did I get pushback? Sure. And lots of people who were actually involved in the making of Valley of the Dolls, you know, they wanted to talk, then they ghosted me. So yeah, that you know, that was an issue. Can you hear like lawnmowers like all surrounding me?
Very faintly, but look, we always get dogs and garbage trucks. So the listeners of this podcast are used to ambient sound.
Not it's cinema verite. So just, you know, it's fine, kids. You know, I live a life in the mountains with, you know, lots of animals around, and everybody's going to have their lawn cut today.
Perfect.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think that any book that anyone undertakes about, you know, a movie that they about, you know, a movie that obsesses them, unless it's, you know, like a really super famous movie, I see that doesn't interest me. I will read any book about, whether it's Sunset Boulevard or it's Chinatown, it's Rosemary's Baby, I will devour it. But I'm not the guy for that job. So I was, you know, I was thrilled when the Psycho book got such acclaim and, you know, it was bought for movies and all that. But what I was more thrilled about was how the reputation of the movie shifted over time. That, you know, suddenly that thing was like, oh, why would you write about that? It's like, oh, you wrote about a masterpiece. Well, you didn't think that when I talked with you all them years ago.
Why aren't you writing about Topaz, Stephen? Torn curtain. We need to know.
Don't tempt me. Don't tempt me. You know, but the thing about Valley is, you know, by no means am I saying that, you know, the culture is going to shift and it will be embraced as the, you know, the masterpiece it was always meant to be. But it was something that I wanted to write for my soul. I wanted to write for Ed Margulies. I wanted to write, you know, to kind of, you know, put kind of to lay some ghosts. And I thought I'd have a lot of fun. I didn't. Because you know, I alluded to earlier that I'm not the same guy that I was when I wrote even, you know, Hitchcock and Making of Psycho, but I'm certainly not the guy that I was when I was going to write this book, or Ed and I were going to write this book the first time around, because now it's impossible for me. It was always impossible for me to watch Valley of the Dolls in recent years and not feel deeply, deeply moved by Sharon Tate, almost to the point where it's almost unbearable. It's just me. But now with Patty Duke, it's the same thing.
Wow.
Because I got so deeply, and I talked with so many people who knew her, knew what she was going through during this, and knew her struggles with what we'd now call, you know, bipolar disorder, and her suicide attempts and multiple addictions and all. It was difficult. And so I had a very, I just had a very different reaction to it. And I was not about to make jokes about it.
And she had the opportunity to tell that story herself and does so, I think, very beautifully in Call Me Anna. I want to go back to the idea of, you know, you say that the reputation of Psycho has changed over the years, but yeah. I would argue that, like, you know, the Criterion Collection release of Valley of the Dolls, to me, feels like an imprimatur that someone is taking this movie more seriously than we used to.
Yes, I think so. But all I was saying is, they're not. It's not Psycho status or Vertigo status.
No! Of course not. But I just wanted to ask you about how this movie has sort of evolved over the years and why there is this. You know, the thing about the thing about the Criterion release is that there are no gay voices on that collection. Like the essay, the video essay, the stuff they kept from the original DVD release and the stuff they didn't, feels like they're trying to divorce it from camp object to sort of neglected feminist masterpiece. I'm not quite sure what the end game here is, but I'm curious about just your thoughts about how this film has evolved over the decades.
Well, it has, and I think it's good and important that feminists are looking again at Jacqueline Suzanne and are looking at that, you know, the prototypes that she was trying to deal with, and there, I think, you know, the same thing that kind of happened with me and Patty Duke. They're looking at the fact that Jacqueline Suzanne was up against it. I mean, we look at her as this indomitable force, and you know, and brilliant at self promotion, and you know, very poochy and presentational and all of that, you know, all of which she was. But she was very canny, and she really got beaten up mostly by the male establishment all the time. And, you know, and it was almost always ad hominem, always about truck driver and drag, or she looks like this, or, you know, she's a typist and not an actual writer, you know, all of those things that she had to deal with all the time. And when you see her interviews, I think she deals with them with great aplomb and style. And those, you know, the John Simons and the
David Capotes.
David Cross and the Truman Capotes of the world wind up looking, you know, like little yappy dogs chewing at her ankles, you know. I heard her say once I was told that she said privately that, you know, if only some of those men had some of the great success that she did with Valley of the Dolls, maybe they'd be a little less mean to her and mean to everyone else. You know, I don't know that that's necessarily true, but I think that feminists, and I think that lots of us recognize that Jackie had a tough road to hoe in terms of, I mean, you know, look, even when she'd written Every Night Josephine and then had written this novel, her, you know, agents and publicists, you'll never guess who's writing a novel, Jackie, and, you know, everyone was laughing, you know, and that's because for one reason, she had tried so many things in New York and in that scene and had failed at them. It's very easy to laugh at someone who, you know, tries and doesn't make it. And, but she did, she triumphed and she kept writing books and she kept trying to be, you know, I always find that the ideas that Jackie came up with for other books that she didn't get to write or because of her death or publishers wouldn't play with them, or were almost always more, you know, at least as interesting as what she did write. I mean, she wanted to write a book about, you know, to use the characters of Milton Berle and his brother, whom he was awful to and cruel to, and look at that kind of family relationship and what it does to scar people. I would have read that. I think it's great that people are looking at the movie in a different way. They're looking at the novel in a different way. And I think what I think is great is that people are embracing that just because you're laughing doesn't mean you're not moved by something. I mean, when, you know, Ed and the people at Movie Line came up with Bad Movies We Love, the love always kept getting ignored. You know, people can, oh, you're mean and you're bitchy and all that stuff. But I think at least what I find with Dolls is that the people who actually, you know, are reviewing it and actually bother to read it, and that's not necessarily the same thing. But the people who read it and are reading it get that there's a lot of warmth and empathy and emotion and respect that I'm giving to these women who had no agency. They, you know, some of them were under contract, or some of them were just, you know, dealing with Hollywood as it is, or it was at the time. And they were, yeah, they're doing the best they can.
I always remember you and Ed were on Joan Rivers's afternoon talk show, and Pia Zadora was on with you, and she asked you, why didn't you put Hairspray in the book? And Ed said, well, that's not a bad movie. And then she said, well, what about Butterfly? And he said, well, it's Bad Movies We Love.
Yeah, Ed. Yeah. Well, yeah, you have to, or otherwise it's just, you know, a rip. Anyone can do that.
In Bad Movies We Love and in this one, it never feels like you're punching down. I think there's always a sense of like, this is absurd, give me more.
Yes, yes. I had no idea what the world would be like when this book came out. And I'm happy that people are, you know, texting and messaging me and putting stuff on social media that say, thank goodness for this book right now. It just, for however many days or hours I was reading that book, the most important thing in the world to me was they're making Valley of the Dolls a movie and look what's happening. And that's a great compliment. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make people as much a fly on the wall and see that other flies were getting swatted like hell, but you won't, you can keep reading and, you know, enjoy or suffer with the other characters. People just need escape, and like Pia Zadora, whom I actually really like, you have to have a sense of humor about yourself, and you have to get it. You know, you kind of have to get what the joke is here. I mean, I'm sure. I don't know. I was going to say I'm sure that both of you, but I don't know that. But I'm going to say that I have taken people to or shown people bad movies that I love, and they've sat there in stony silence without laughing once, or like, what is wrong with you? But I've also I've been at movies that I deeply love, like say The Innocents, and heard entire audiences fall on the floor with laughter. And it kills me, because I just think it's, you know, it's Henry James, it's, you know, it's Jack Clayton, it's Deborah Carr giving a performance of a lifetime. So, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
Yeah, Dave and I have learned over the years which rooms to show, like Boom to, or the musical numbers from Lost Horizon.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, you know what that's like. And it's, you know, it isn't intelligent. As you well know, it's not gender. It's not intelligence. It's not anything. You know, you've got that gene, or you don't. I mean, I don't even know if I have the gene, but my dad did. And so he would take me to movies, and this is how I hear my dad at the movies. Because he was always snorting, you know, he was chortling at when it, but he had that built in, oh, this is too much now. Or, he was a very, very funny guy. But then, see, my mom would take me to see Susan Hayward movies, or she would take me to Lana Turner movies, or we'd watch them on TV. And then like a week later, she'd be wearing what one of them was wearing because she knew how to sew it. I would watch her eyes narrow and go, I know how to do that. And I'd rock that dress. And so I would know which Jean-Louis ensemble she was going to wear to church next week because she was on it. So I was really lucky to have that kind of, those confluences, with parents who loved movies, but also had that step back. I mean, I remember seeing Zhivago with my parents at a beautiful theater in Boston, Roadshow, and just, it was so swank and swell. And it's David Lean, it's Pasternak. The train is going across the screen. And my mother goes out loud, what a ridiculous toy that is, And so that's where I'm from. So they would get bad, my folks weren't alive when I did bad movies with them, but they would have gotten it, they totally would have gotten it, and they would have been probably snorting along with me. But my mom, I have to say though, my mom did not find Ross Hunter movies funny.
Oh, that's...
But she loved them. But she was Madame X-ing it all.
Well, as long as she got outfit ideas, then it was not.
Well, that's all that was important, really.
The book is Dolls, Dolls, Dolls. It is out now from Random House Penguin, available in paperback and as a Kindle. The paperback is lavishly. Does the Kindle have the photos too?
I don't know. Honestly, I should, but I don't.
I haven't finished the Kindle yet, so if they're in there, I haven't found them. But they're definitely in the paperback.
The audiobook doesn't have the pictures either, but,
There's an audiobook? I didn't know.
Yeah, there is. It's just creeping out.
Read by you?
No, but listen to my voice. Don't you think I should have?
That seems like a perfect fit to me.
I think you and Dave should have done it. And I want to hear Dave's Helen Lawson for sure.
As long as you don't hire the woman that read the unabridged Valley audiobook, who keeps pronouncing the Gaucheros the Gaucheras. Like it's very proper and it's all wrong.
And if you don't know who the Gaucheros are, shame on you. Go back to the book and read.
Absolutely. Anyway, Stephen, congratulations. I have wanted this book to exist for I don't know how long, and to have it exist at your hand is just like the icing on the cake.
That's very sweet. Thank you so much.
So everybody, thanks for tuning in. We'll be back Sunday with our regularly scheduled program, but pick up the book. Have a good summer, and Steve, we'll talk to you soon.
Yes, I look forward to it.
Thank you. Bye, Stephen.
And until next time,
goodbye.